Okay, Erev Tov to Kulam. Good evening. It is it's great to see you all. These smiling faces who are coming together to talk about a very light topic here on a Sunday night. So it's good to see you. I want to welcome, I see my mother is on here. Hello, Mom. I also see my in-laws are on here as well. So hello, Norman and Helene and Marlene. And I want to welcome. We have two very special guests with us today, this evening. We have Rabbi Dr. Judah Goldberg, who you see. Hello, Rabbi Goldberg. It's a pleasure to have you here with us this evening. And who many of you, all of you, know already. So Etta, it's great to have you here as well to join us for this Sunday night evening conversation. So. Let me tell you. Let me give a little bit of background, and we're going to meet our two interviewees and continue from there. I just want to make clear that we are going to make time for questions. So hold your questions, and we'll make sure there's time at the end for people to ask questions, give comments, etc. So it was just a few weeks ago that Rabbi Goldberg, who I know from back in the day in Teaneck, a few years older than me, and actually the same age as my brother-in-law. Sent an article that he had written. He sent it to the Gush Rabbinic Listserv, article called A Halachic Framework for Decision-Making in Acute Critical Illness. We'll talk about what that is in just a second. And I saw this, I'm like, wow, this is really an important topic. And I read through the article and saw that really he comes to a very interesting conclusion about some of these issues. His article was then endorsed. I'm just going to ask everyone to mute themselves if you don't mind. Let me just do that myself. Okay. His article was then endorsed by great poskim, Rav Herschel Schechter, Rav Mordechai Willig Shlita, both of them from Yeshiva University. And Annette and I were talking through this, and I said, hey, this is an interesting topic to explore. The medical side of acute illness and critical care, as well as the pastoral, emotional, spiritual side, and to bring these two disciplines together in one conversation. So we conceived of this idea, and here we are. Voila, we're here to talk about these issues from both a medical, halachic, as well as an emotional and spiritual standpoint. So I'd like to welcome the two interviewees and Rabbi Goldberg. Would you please tell us a little bit about your life experience and the work that you do? Sorry, I'm just going to unmute you 1 second. Unmute and... Okay, just make sure you're unmuted there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Avetan. Thank you for inviting me to this wonderful evening for this whole forum. And it's a pleasure to be here with your whole community. I'll start by introducing myself. My name is Judah Goldberg. I do two things in life, mainly. One is I'm an emergency physician. I work at Shari Tzedek in Yerushalayim, and when there's not a worldwide pandemic, I also work for a few weeks a year in South Florida. And I also have the pleasure of teaching Torah currently in MMY in a post-high school seminary for school in Yerushalayim. In my work as an emergency physician, I'm at the receiving end of acute critical illness. Those patients, when they get admitted, will move on to an intensive care unit, typically. But we see critical patients all the time. And I'd say they come mostly in two groups. Some of them, it's unanticipated illness. It could be trauma. It could be sudden infection. It could be heart attacks, things that are completely unanticipated. And other times we see patients who unfortunately actually have a significant underlying chronic illness who may have been deteriorating over time, some more slowly, some more quickly, and then problem over problem, piles on top of problem, and they come into us, the patient is unfortunately very, very ill. And often in context of the emergency department, not only in the emergency department, the issues obviously come up in for inpatients as well, but we're often in the position of trying to make decisions about what kind of aggressive measures to take for a patient. Probably one of the most classic or typical dilemmas is whether a patient who can't breathe for themselves ought to be intubated, ought to be put onto a ventilator. And those are the situations that I was really seeking to address. If I can elaborate, Eitan, for a moment, situations of end-of-life care are already well described in the halachic literature. Situations where a patient has a definite irreversible prognosis, and the question is, to what degree does one have to take extraordinary measures to perpetuate life, even in the short term? And there's somewhat of a consensus amongst the postgame that if the patient is suffering or the treatment itself involves a good deal of suffering, that would not be necessary. What I felt personally from my own experience was there was a certain gap was in patients who weren't necessarily terminal. You couldn't apply any definite prognosis, but everyone in the picture, family members, physicians, often the patient themselves understood that this is unlikely to have a good outcome, that the prognosis is poor, and particularly
and there's a lack of information in those, or lack of
often and that can cut both ways, meaning the uncertainty of the situation, particularly is in the emergency department, is difficult to contend with. Sometimes because of uncertainty, we tend to err on the side of being more aggressive. At the same time, sometimes you reach a situation where, despite the unknowns, there's some unspoken feeling that this is not going to be a patient's best interest. The doctors can't say there's no chance of survival, and the patient doesn't insist on it.
These are cases that you're dealing with on a regular basis, right? You're in emergency care, if I understand correctly, right?
In emergency medicine, hold on
just one second. I want to walk you through the article and analyze some of the halachic analysis that you do. Just one second. I just want to jump back for one second. That's just to tell us a little bit about some of your work as a chaplain. How'd you get into this, and what exactly is a chaplain? It's not a term that we throw around here much in Israel. Maybe just describe what that is.
Okay, thank you. It's really great to be here. It's a real zchut to be speaking with you, Rev Goldberg. Thank you for joining us. Just even before I launch in, I just want to acknowledge being here with all of you as also the Rebbetzin of a community, a amazing community. And some of you, in fact, even here during this past crisis of a pandemic, have also experienced quite a bit of loss and grief. And I just want to acknowledge that. And recognize that some of the things that we're going to address tonight may even trigger some things. And I just want to put it out there that, you're in a really amazing community, thank God, and you have resources wherever you are. So as a Rebbetzin here, I just want to acknowledge that and let you know. Now sort of putting my hat back on as a professional chaplain, what is that? What is that? So I'm happy to just... because it's not so clear, I'm just I'll take you through just very briefly that in order to become a chaplain or in Israel, it's a little different. It's called a melava ruchanit or the field of livui ruchani. But back in America, I had to complete 1,600 hours of clinical pastoral education, which included supervision and included actually clinical care. And I worked as the chaplain in hospital settings, also hospice care. But I worked in psychiatric, emergency, stroke recovery, intensive care units at NYU Lutheran Hospital. I ran spiritual care groups, memorial services as well. And became certified in 2016. But I'm telling you that because it's not just chaplaincy. Sometimes people hear that and they assume it's end of life care. And it's not just that. It's really working with people at any state of trauma, illness, crisis, unknown, difficulty, loss, bereavement, and grief. So I'm trained also to do grief counseling. But after my work in residency, I worked in palliative care specifically, and then hospice. I did again hospice chaplaincy in home hospice, and with and also running the pediatric hospice chaplaincy team. And that's actually what I was doing when when we made Aliyah 3.5 years ago. So since making Aliyah, I became certified in Livui Ruchani here. There's an amazing Milava Ruchani or Livui Ruchani department in the Rambam hospital way up in Haifa. Just to tell you very little bit about it, chaplaincy, it's, you may think, okay, something similar to maybe what a social worker could do. In other words, you know, sitting with and talking to and making space for someone to express what is going on in their lives, how they really make meaning out of difficult situations. And that's what I see my role is, discussing, going to some of the, leaning into some of the difficult places that other people often are afraid to, talking to people about their hopes or their fears, and really providing that listening ear, but really listening for, doing a kind of spiritual assessment is what I call it. Understanding what their concerns are. I often will, specifically related to this conversation of like of end of life, or somebody who's, you know, received a horrible diagnosis or even terminal diagnosis, I would identify three main concerns that I would classify as spiritual concerns that come up that I'm there to address. And the first one is really the question of whether their life had or has meaning, and what has or what does really matter in their life. And there's so many emotions that come up with that. So my role is to help patients to, you know, reconcile strained relationships. And that includes also with God as well. And to help facilitate life review, you know, taking accounting of their lives. There's so many times I'll walk into a room and people will say, you know, when I introduce myself as a chaplain, they understand, they'll say, why would God do this to me? And I sit with them and I don't have an answer until I ask them, well, tell me about your relationship with God. And it's people of all different faiths, all different backgrounds. And this is how, in fact, I actually worked primarily with patients that weren't Jewish. I would get the secular Jews when I was working in hospice, because all the Jews were assigned to the rabbis who were trained chaplains. So that's the first concern. Did my life have meaning? The second is the concern about dying an appropriate death, a death adherent to somebody's values, which I know Rav Goldberg, you're going to speak a little bit more about. What's most important to them? What did they want? Who do they still need to see? Their goal setting, their medical planning. And then the third is the hopes and the fears beyond death.
Okay, so what I like about this is that there really are, you guys are looking at the same problems in a sense, but from two totally different angles. And of course there's overlap, because I imagine, Rabbi Goldberg, that when you sit with a patient, you don't look at them just as a medical patient, you look at them as a whole person. But let's walk through, I wanna now move to your article for a second. You make a clear distinction between end-of-life care versus acute critical life care. And you say that when it comes to end-of-life care, halachas already has things mostly mapped out. What do poskim tell us when it comes to end-of-life care? You know someone's going to die, they're terminally ill. What does halacha say you have to do in these situations? When do you give care? When can you refrain from giving care?
Sure. So like everything in halacha, there's a range of opinions. But there has been a pretty broad consensus that has been built around the idea that there are outcomes worse than death. There are things that patients can go through that are actually...
Sorry, let me just... I'm just going to ask everyone, please mute yourself unless you're the speakers right now. Yeah, go on, Rabbi.
Sure. This was established by Rav Moshe Feinstein. It was... seconded by Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and we can add other names to that list. And Rav Moshe established there are outcomes that are worse than death, and therefore, if a patient's in a terminal situation where that trajectory is irreversible, where their suffering cannot be alleviated, then, and it's clearly not in their interest to receive further care, then no further care ought to be given.
Wait a second. I want to jump in here for a second. We know that Judaism believes the value of life. Life is so important. The chai bahem. We were at a funeral recently, and I was at, happened to be of a Haredi family, and they said that we kept trying to resuscitate. We wanted to just, every single second of life is kadosh, is holy. Are you telling me that that's not Judaism's perspective?
No, I'm not. But then indeed, every moment of life is holy. But I guess I'll just reiterate exactly how Rav Moshe states it, that there are outcomes worse than death. And despite the fact that every moment is holy, that doesn't mean a person has to suffer to somehow to squeeze every moment out of life. I think I like to mention that there's a letter by the Stipler Gaon, Rav Yaakov Kanievsky, Rav Chaim Kanievsky's father, where he's addressing someone about this issue and says on this idea that you present that in Judaism we have to do everything to extend life as much as possible. He says, I too heard this when I was young in my youth, that I'm not sure where it comes from. Perhaps it's some kind of tradition, but when I got older and I learned the sources, I learned the Shulchan Aruch, I saw that it's not so clear. Now, what always intrigues me about this letter is that his youth was not with modern technology. His youth was in the town of Hornstipler, where he got his name from, the Stipler Gaon, which I assume is Litter, Poland. Someone correct me if I'm wrong, in the early 20th century. And I can't imagine what kind of medical debates they were having at the time about whether to extend or not extend life. But yet the same conversation was happening 100 years ago in pre-war Europe. And Stipler saying even then he thinks that the sanctity of life was not that the sanctity was exaggerated, but the responsibility towards that sanctity was exaggerated even by that time.
Mm-hmm. And would you say, would you say that the problem's gotten worse 100 years later? I mean, is this a prevalent problem? I mean, is this something that's so much, I mean, what would you say? What do you see in, your own medical practice?
I'd say, again, I differentiate between two separate situations. One is end of life care, mm-hmm. and the other one is critical illness. And they're not, I wouldn't say they're problems. I'd say they are the consequences of medical capabilities and medical technologies. If I put it most bluntly, let's say in terms of end of life care, we have the ability, it doesn't always work, but we have the ability to at least attempt to resuscitate a person after their heart has stopped beating effectively. Now, the quandary that puts us in is that medically speaking, a person isn't really, what do you call death? A person's not really, medically speaking, a person's not dead until they've clinically died and resuscitation has been attempted and they're still dead. Meaning that resuscitation, at least an attempt at it, is always possible. And so suddenly what went from being a natural process of dying has become almost the unnatural, that a patient, has to decline to want resuscitation in the case of a heart stopping in order to die what for thousands of years was considered a natural death. I don't think that's a curse. I think in some ways that's it's opportunity, but it needs to be managed with nuance and with sophistication. I think doctors require sophistication and sometimes it's lacking there. I think certainly patients and families, the more that they can understand the nuances of situations, the better kinds of decisions they can make. That's in terms of a terminal illness. If I'll just add a word of critical illness, the description I give of critical illness is patients who have life-threatening disease where we don't know if it is the end of life. We will only know after the fact. In hindsight, we will know, was that the end of life? Was that an irrecoverable situation that no matter how heavily we bombarded the body and the illness, still we could not salvage it? Or indeed, there was some possibility of survival there. And even so, we have to talk about what kind of survival. And so that adds the big element of uncertainty. And even there, I think medicine is still struggling how to make good choices, not right choices, because often there's no right choice, but how to make good choices that seem to be in the best interest of the patient, and ultimately in consistent with their own instincts of what would be appropriate.
Mm-hmm. And what is your halakhic argument with regards to acute critical illness? Who makes the decision? Do you have to go to a prosaic? Do you have to always apply maximal intervention? Who do you think makes, you know, has the right to make decisions in these situations? And are there any sources that you would bring to prove your point?
Sure. So my argument, I don't have any novelty involved, any chiddush. My argument is that if you adapt the responsa of Rav Moshe Feinstein primarily, as well as Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, if you adapt them to the scenario of critical illness, then they themselves dictate a certain openness, I would say, that patients and or their families, either with the help of their families or their families in their place, if they're incapable of making their own medical decisions, can follow their own instincts about what is in the patient's best interest. In my opinion, and I was very privileged in the context of this article, that it didn't remain my opinion, that I was privileged to get the endorsement of, as you said, Rav Schechter and Rav Willig, two esteemed poskim, that halacha is decided, is deciding that within a certain range, I mean, someone can as a truly outlandish position that can be questioned, but within a certain range of what would be considered mainstream, patients should feel empowered to reach their own decisions about what's in their best interest. If a particular course of action is suggested, and given their background frailty, given their underlying diseases, given the poor prognosis and poor chance of meaningful recovery, and ultimately the possible suffering involved, that patients can weigh all that and come to their own conclusions. I think halacha has paskined, or I'd say it differently, Rav Schechter and Rav Willig have paskined, that patients have this autonomy and capability. And if people want to consult clergy, whether it's Rabbanim in their decision-making capacities, in their pastoral capacities, of course, they're welcome to consult, but no one needs a heter, or they have the heter, I should say, already to make the decisions that seem to be in their best interest in mm-hmm. these critical.
I would just jump in.
Yeah.
Sorry. I would just jump in and say that that really, really, you know, coincides with the what you had written as well about truth telling. Of really giving the patients the ability to understand what is going on with them. One of the questions I often get is, you know, the doctor hasn't spoken to my mother who has some form of dementia, whatever stage it is, hasn't spoken to my mother, let's say, about how her cancer has returned, and should I be talking to her about it? And it's often a Jewish patient, they're very concerned because of what the Shulchan Aruch says, and oftentimes there's a way to facilitate a conversation where, you know, instead of saying, oh, you're just going to be fine, but to say, you know, are there some things that you worry about? And really, really addressing the emotional aspects behind that and bringing patient autonomy to life, or to understand the values of what a patient would have wanted, which is more of a value-based assessment. So really appreciate bringing that up as well.
Yeah, so did you want to answer, Judah?
Say thank you, Anthony, for bringing up this other article I had written on truth telling. That one did not have any rabbinic endorsements, but it really followed the same pattern that I tried to say not to say anything that I didn't think could be argued out of the Chuvas or Moshe Feinstein himself, who I've brought him up multiple times. I find him to be really remarkable in terms of his sensitivity to situations of illness, and particularly his focus on autonomy for patients. And so I think there's a common denominator in the two scenarios that we've talked about. One, to make medical decisions for oneself, to be able to weigh those risks and benefits. And of one of those decisions aside, is one capable of having a frank discussion about prognosis and to decide whether that will help or hurt? That's just as much a patient's decision and prerogative as any other medical decision.
Hmm. And the final piece of your article, Rabbi Goldberg, I just want to ask you, there was a case by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the famous Tana who composed the Mishnah, and that seemed to be an important source. What was critical about that source that you drew out from it?
Sure, the source, it's picked up by some Rishonim, and ultimately it is the focal point of Rav Moshe Feinstein's Shuvas as well. The Gemara tells a story of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who was gravely ill. In fact, it's actually not even clear how gravely ill he was. It's really interesting to read it inside. We don't have the chance to do that right now. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was very ill, and the Rabbanim were gathered outside of davening for him. And the Gemara says that a maidservant, that someone who knew him intimately from inside his house, she commented that Shemaim rotzim et Rebbe v'aretz rotzeh et Rebbe, that God and his ministering angels are calling for Rebbe, and yet the people are holding on with their tefillot, they're holding on. And at first she davened, she said, Yehi ratzon, that the people should overpower the will of God, and that their tefillot should keep Rebbe with us in this world. And then the Gemara says, when she saw how much Rebbe was suffering, and it's interesting, actually, that what's the example of suffering, of the difficulty with which he took off his tefillin and put them back on every time that he had to use the bathroom. He apparently had some kind of gastrointestinal illness, that she realized that the suffering was not worthwhile for him. And so she said, I hope that Shamayim overpowers Aretz. And still the tefillot were too powerful. So she took some kind of vessel, threw it down to the ground, kind of startled the Rabbanim for just a moment. And in that moment of where there was some brief pause in their tefillot, that Rebbe's soul departed. Mm-hmm. So again, this is the basis, the fundamental contention that there are outcomes worse than death, there is suffering worse than death. This is something that one of the Rishonim, the Ran, learns from the story. And then Rav Moshe Feinstein quotes the Ran to that effect as well. And that's the basis for his psak. I think one observation about the story, which is quite interesting, is that so often the Gemara gives us stories and it leaves it somewhat not ambiguous, but open to interpretation. The Gemara doesn't feel the need to spell out its lessons. It leaves it open. And so we as readers peer and we see this contrast between Rabbanim and the Shifcha and the maidservant. The Rabbanim, they daven fervently. And we don't know. Is that because they had a different read of the situation? Is because they had a different theological understanding? Or simply because as dedicated as they were as students, they were students. And that was the role for them to play. And then we have someone who tends to Rebbe, who's at his bedside, and who understands his situation from inside his house, so to speak. And for her, she may not be the most learned of the group, but she seems to have an intuition more than anyone of what is best for Rebbe, and she takes action. And again, the Gemara doesn't really spell this out for us, but the story carries all that meaning. And I think it's important to reflect on when we think about exactly this discussion about who is best situated to understand a patient's plight and therefore to make medical decisions in their interest.
And that was your chidush, that it's the family, it's the people sitting with the person, the people who know him and or her, and the baseline situation. Okay, so really, really, really interesting that the conclusions you come to and the Gemaras you draw from. So I want to add to that.
Can I add to that story?
Yeah, sure.
Because it is a fundamental text for for preserving or for understanding a patient's, a person's dignity, which I do believe is something, dignity can be something that goes beyond death. I'm sure you're getting at. And I would also say that from what I understand, the run learns from this story, learns from this, that we actually have the ability to pray. We can pray. We don't have to only pray for refuah shleima, refuah shleima, refuah shleima. Sometimes there's also room to pray for the comfort of a person. And it's actually one of the things, a question that I often ask. I often bring to, if I'm learning a little bit more about a family, or especially a family who, is steeped in some sort of either spiritual or, spirituality, whatever faith group, religious or non-religious, and I'll say, what is it that you're hoping or praying for? And it's amazing because you hear the mixed voices. You hear, I'm praying for a miracle. I'm praying I will do whatever it takes just to keep, my father in this world, the Rebbe in this world. I will do whatever it takes. And then other people say, I just want him to stop suffering. I want him to have comfort. And therein lies, the challenge and the sometimes the tension of in conflict in families as well.
Interesting. Yeah. If I could just add something to what Etha said, it's I think we all find that challenge, especially facing patients who are very, very ill and perhaps terminal, or at least have a very poor prognosis. What is it we wish for them? What comfort do we offer? You say the words refuah shleima, and yet they seem so empty often. Mm. And I recall that when my own grandmother was very, very ill, that my mother always recalls that a rabbi in the family, when he spoke to her, he said to her, may God be gentle. Mm. And somehow it was the right words. And my mother, it was very meaningful to her. And I've adopted that sentence for myself, that in the right context, to wish someone that may God be gentle, and it seems to speak to people.
Hmm. Wow, beautiful, beautiful. So I want to now turn to the pastoral side of this, okay? And it seems like, there was a book that came out a few years ago by Atul Gawande, which is called Being Mortal, which was a top seller in the New York Times list. And he spoke about how we address death in modern society has really shifted. For the most part, people, because we have so many medical capabilities, we just keep trying to fix and to solve a treatment, a diagnosis. But what is it, even when people know that there's no real future, that their loved one is dying or their loved one has a few months left, do you sit with families in these situations? What is it that's holding them back? And even if they're not halacha Jews who feel that they have to follow through with v'chai b'hem, what holds them back from refraining from giving care? And tell us maybe some of the stories that have come through in addressing these types of questions.
I mean, the story that I'm thinking of that's comes right to my to me. One second, is your door open?
I hear you. I think so.
Okay. I hear. So one of the stories is, a man, young man in his 60s, unfortunately, was dying of kidney failure. This is when I was working in the palliative care in the VA, which is the Veterans Affairs Hospital in Brooklyn. And so unfortunately, he was dying of kidney failure, and we had been trying to get a hold of his daughter by phone, his really one healthcare proxy, to discuss the decisions needed to make in palliative care about, and really there are, as Rav Goldberg had mentioned, I mean, several decisions that needed to be made, but in this case was to stop dialysis, to keep going. And this father had been in and out of the hospital, for 2 years. He had strokes, and now he was on dialysis, and whether or not to withdraw the dialysis. And he was not responding clearly. Finally, I got on the phone with her and I asked her how effectively, you know, I started to talk and how do you think that dialysis is working? So starting with very practical, and she said, well, you know, the doctors have told me that it's not really doing any good at this point. And I said, well, did your father ever give any indication of what he would have wanted, right? Like, again, giving to the values or the autonomy of the patient himself. She said, yes. She said he would never have wanted to be on dialysis. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing on the one hand, but I was also absolutely not surprised because this was happening so many times in my work that there was this, you know, as I'll explain, a little bit of a cognitive dissonance. And I said to her, there's no question then. You should stop the treatment based on his desire. But what is holding you back? And she started to choke up. She started to cry. And, you know, in this moment, she said, I guess I feel so guilty because I haven't been visiting him enough in the past couple of years. Now, this was a woman in her 30s. She had young children. It was really hard for her to practically make it to her father, who was like in a hospital 2 hours away. And she felt a tremendous amount of guilt. This is one of the things that holds people back. It's this emotional, you know, grief, guilt. And I sat with her and acknowledging the desire to try and keep him alive. But it was coming from a place of this guilt. So, you know, essentially we were treating the wrong, it's sometimes we end up treating the wrong person. We're treating the family member. You know, we're giving this father, this patient, trying to cure, aggressively, you know, treat something that is really not having any intended positive effect. In fact, actually, you know, becoming very, very, maybe even insufferable for him. But we're doing it for the guilt of a daughter. And so what I ended up doing, of course, she was able to, I talked with her about what is it that she needs, because that's not where my job ends. Now it's like, okay, what do you need in order to address this? And she really needed to speak to her father. She was avoiding it, but to share certain things, to share that, you know, she loved him and she wanted to thank him and to ask for forgiveness, to really ask for forgiveness. And to also, you know, to reconcile certain parts of their relationship. Even if he was often, you know, in and out of consciousness. And so the next time that she was able to come, I sat with her and facilitated that conversation with her father, and that she was able to let go. But you can see right there that this is an emotional, spiritual, decision, and people are afraid. They're afraid that it's a defeat that, and I just wanted to say that point about like really speaking through what needs to be said to somebody. I believe it's really never too early to have certain conversations about how one really feels about and what one really wants to say.
I want to hear more about that, about some of the life lessons both of you sure. take out from working with people in these situations. We're gonna get there soon. I mean, I'm curious, Rabbi Judah, do you, you know, you're a doctor, but I know you to be someone who also, you know, tries to be a humane doctor and addresses some of the emotional needs of your patients. You know, how do you facilitate some? I'm curious, how do you, you know, what's it like for you to facilitate a conversation about some of these things? Any stories that come to mind?
It's interesting. Certainly what Esther resonates with me. It's also, I find myself in a peculiar place in the hospital, which is the emergency department, where time is not one of our resources, unfortunately. I think the conversation, you know, it comes to mind. My dear wife Shane has just finished writing a book about decision making, about trust and fear, and her basic thesis is that you can make decisions out of fear. You can make decisions out of trust, and that ultimately one has to own one's decisions and take responsibility. And there is no way to shirk that responsibility or run away from it. I'll talk about myself and my own emotional burdens for a moment. I talked about resuscitation earlier. patient's heart stops beating. Patient's younger, patient's older, either way, you try to resuscitate that patient and it's not working. Well, how long do you try? When is the resuscitation over? 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes? The answer is there's no medical definition. There's no cutoff. There's no point at which patient is insalvageable. And it becomes on the physician's shoulders to look around the room and consult the team that you're working with. Say, is there anything we haven't tried? Does anyone have any more ideas? We've given this a lot of rounds. At some point, you say, that's it. And I have to walk away from that. And more than once, later that day and that night in bed and the next day, you know, there's that voice in your head saying, well, maybe just one more round of CPR. Maybe just one more round would have done it. How do you know? How do you know it wouldn't have turned around? And I guess part of growing up, which I'm still in the process of doing, is realizing that you have to own decisions and there is nobody. There is nobody else to shoulder that with you. So it's certainly true in terms of physicians. And I think it's true in terms of families in particular as well. It's interesting. And I wonder if we have a chance you can come back to this. So much we talk about the families and their decision-making, almost skipping over that sometimes patients actually are in a position to make their own decisions and how that dynamic plays out so differently. But if we talk about families, I think that middle of the night decision that Safta's not breathing well, Safta's lungs are failing and either we're going to intubate or we're not. And I see that stricken look on families' faces. What do you do? And more than once I found myself saying to them, I said, I just want you to realize there is no out. There's no stuff, what I call suffik lahachmir. There's no way of being stringent. No matter what you choose to do in this moment, 6 months from now, you're going to still wonder about it. And there's nothing you can do to avoid that. No choice is going to make you rest easier about that. This is the burden, what you have, and you need to face it head on and just do what you think is right. I think that doesn't always make it easier. It doesn't make the responsibility any lighter. But the idea of empowering people that I think about it in theological terms, that one of our fundamental beliefs is in the power of free choice. And free choice doesn't just mean that you're free to choose what you want. It means we have to believe that God empowers us to make good choices and to encourage people and empower people at the most difficult crossroads of life. You have the ability to make a good choice. God is empowering you. You'll never know. You'll never kind of get the pat on the back from God, but you can feel that you have the ability to make a good choice. Sometimes I think is the greatest gift that we can give people.
Wow, very powerful. And anything you want to share on this point of how does the spiritual element of your work help people to find, I'm not sure the right word is comfort, but closure with some of the decisions that they make? And how does that play a role in this?
You know, so I really love what you just said, Rav Goldberg. And, you know, I've spoken to patients or the family members doing bereavement work with people months after their loved one died. And sometimes they'll say, I've actually heard this more than a few times. They'll say, we should have stopped treatment earlier. They'll say, we should have stopped treatment earlier so that, you know, I didn't have to, you know, the artificial hydration or artificial nutrition, you know, it got in the way of me being able to like really hug and hold and be with, you know, my whatever it was, my relative, my dying relative. And I really crave that. It's just fascinating to hear. In the moment though, and the this critical moment that you're talking about being in that emergency room and trying to make that decision. Because the example that I gave earlier about, there's sort of time, dialysis, whatnot. We're not talking about CPR. I mean, that was a huge, huge moment. People come into the ICU and then suddenly it's, do we administer CPR or not? And this is absolutely when people's spiritual, and when I say spiritual, I mean religious, but also non-religious resources come into play. And when I'm there, I ask right there, what is your belief? What are you hoping and praying for at this moment? And really it's about helping them to connect to what is most important. And then also if they are, I'll give you an example, this woman who I was working with who was refusing, this wasn't life or death. Well, it was eventually, but this was a woman who was refusing a blood transfusion and nobody could understand why. And I sat with her. It turns out she was Jehovah's Witness. And she says, I'm not allowed to have that. So being able to really understand what was it that that either calls us to do something or not, I was able to actually get somebody from her church to come and talk to her. She ended up accepting, which was, amazing. But the moment of calling upon one's spiritual resources and being okay with the nuance that, especially as Jews, it's okay to withhold, so to prevent prolonged suffering. I've definitely seen that.
So I want to pick up, and we're coming to the end here. So get your questions ready for those who have questions. So what do you think about having some of these conversations before, like ahead of time? I mean, is that counter to Jewish values, halachic values, to have conversations about end of life care before these things actually need to be addressed? Sort of connected to this, what life lessons, what is it that people really do want? What lessons do you learn from working with people, both of you, people at end of life or an acute illness? What are the things that are really important in life? So those two questions is what I want to conclude with. So I'll give you both a chance to answer.
I have a technical answer and a more existential answer. Technical answer, I think it's worth highlighting that Rav Mordechai Willig and Rav Schechter wrote a postscript where they added their own thoughts on decision making in critical illness, and they were even more. I was not Mechadish, they were Mechadish. I simply said, based on Rav Moshe Feinstein, you can withhold care when it doesn't seem to be in your best interest. And they went further and said, for patients who have little to no cognitive function, that also that itself is a reason to withhold care. And one of the things that they write is that they think it's very important to get that message out and to tell people, not just so people know what their options are, but so that people won't be so terrified of critical illness. That there's some patients who are actually salvageable, and intubation in a short term, let's say on a ventilator, could actually reverse them. And so because they're so terrified of the horror stories they've heard, they don't even want to think about it. And Rabbi Willig says, if you tell them that, they're not getting on a train that has no end, that there's other branch points where you can make decisions. To be clear, they're not talking about withdrawing care, they're talking about only withholding care, which itself is a very nuanced issue. But maybe you can actually encourage people to pursue aggressive care where they otherwise might have declined it. So that's a very practical consideration. And that was driving Willig and Rav Schechter, which I have to admit I wasn't even thinking about. The second factor is, I think we're all thinking about death these days. if we weren't born, you know, in a setting of Jewish anxiety, if we weren't born thinking about death, then certainly a pandemic helps. And I think ever since I turned 40, I can't let go of it. It's haunting me. And one day I had the sudden epiphany that is that we wake up every morning, we say Elokai Neshama, and we think that we start by talking about the day by talking about life. And I realized it's quite the opposite. We start our days by talking about death. Hmm. We say that we have our neshama for a certain amount of time. And I'm just going to put it on the table from the moment I wake up. I'm going to just put it on the table that this existence is temporary. It's transient. And I start the day not with that sobriety. I start the day with that, I don't know, with facing it. Oh, but first and foremost, that that life is contingent. And I think that's what I think it's okay to talk about death. I think we if we notice we talk about death, I think you know, I don't know if it's someone that can psychoanalyze me afterwards. I drop hints here and there. I'll say to my teenage children that on my Matseva, this is what I want you to write, or in my Levaya. Now, I hope that's, I may have asked him, I hope that's many years from now, but one day when it's relevant, I don't want it to take my children by surprise. I want them to get there and realize, you know what, we actually did anticipate this, even in some very subtle, even subconscious ways ahead of time.
Hmm. Well, thank you. Thank you. Very powerful response. Okay, Etha,
thank you.
What do you want to share?
I mean, I would absolutely agree that it's never too early to have these conversations. And there are abundance of resources to have them. There are specific forms even that that families can fill out and even to help talk you through these points. In fact, those who are here with us right now, I'm going to put, this is one of many resources here in Israel. I'm putting it on the chat for everyone to see. You could pull it up on your own time or copy and paste. But this is a conversation project, essentially, that helps people have these conversations because sometimes it's really hard for people to find the language, like how to start. And even though, you know, in this excerpt, it tells you that 90% of people think it's important to talk about the preferences for end of life, but only about 27% have done so. This is from 2012. I don't know exactly what the numbers are like these days, but to help people articulate what is important to them now, what matters most to you? And because this will affect not the quantity of life, but the quality of life that one hopes to live. I'll tell you, actually, out of all of the patients that I really sat with, I remember this one man, this old man who was this Yiddish socialist. And we would speak a little bit in Yiddish and we would sing songs. And the palliative care team kept on saying, Etta, go talk to him. I don't know what he wants. I just don't know what he wants. And I would sit with him and he was able to say to me, I don't think there's a God, he said. I think after this, that's it. There's nothing else. So I want to be in this world for as long as possible, even if I'm not even really here. And it was based on certain background, but he was really adamant. He had this, out of all of these patients that I met with, I've never heard such a clear, decisive, decision that he would want to be connected to machines. And this was his choice. This was, for the most part, many people actually really value the quality of life of relationships, of being in relationship with others, of being having the ability to choose to either end up dying at home versus in a hospital if possible.
I mean, this is something we've spoken about quite a bit, that You know, and I think Gawande also picks this up on his book that, you know, if you're in the hospital for the last few weeks of your life and you're hooked up to machines, you don't have that intimate time with one's family. And sometimes it's better to refrain from care but have some quality of life than to keep trying when there's really, it's not really going to work. And this is what you're picking up on, that the you know, being able to die at home around loved ones is also important. And as opposed to trying to fix death, we sort of embrace it and confront it, in a sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I want to open up the floor. Anyone have any questions or comments or that they want to share or ask any of our speakers at this point in time? Anybody? You could either write the question in on the chat, or you could just sort of pipe up and ask your question. Would anybody like to, any takers here? Okay.
I have a question, Rabbi.
Sure. Arjun, go for it.
I just wanted, actually.
Wait, I'm just losing you here. I can't hear you so well. Just try that again, Audrey. Yeah, sorry, just start again, Audrey, if you don't mind.
Right. So I'm just trying to visualize all of this and to think about what that would mean to have those conversations and what the reality of that is. And then the question is, how does that actually play out? Let's say you're in the hospital, maybe families have had conversations, but then there's an emergency situation and things, that's not a time to be, you know, taking out your wish list. And you've maybe never even met your doctor before. How does that practically play out? You know, if someone is so lucky as to have someone like you who is knowledgeable both in medicine and in halacha, then maybe the person can put their full faith in the decisions that you're going to make. But those decisions are being made very quickly. And I don't know if there's time for conversations between the medical staff and the family.
That's an excellent question. And that is it's a real challenge. I experience the challenge on my end. Sometimes family isn't even present. Sometimes you're doing it by phone. You're trying to reach people by phone. Sometimes it's unanticipated. Hateable, that's the word. There's a sudden illness and you're thrown into it and you deal with it as it's unfolding. What I would say is that the majority of critical illness that we see is unfolding in people who already have longstanding chronic illnesses of all different kinds. But frequently, I agree with you that patients come to the emergency department and some quick decisions need to be made. And it's clear that no conversation has ever happened. It's almost surprising. There's, I can't quote you the literature. Maybe Ethan knows the literature on this. The percent of oncology patients who have terminal illness, but who have never had a frank conversation with their oncologist about what is going to happen and what are the likely scenarios and how would you want to handle each of those? And so, yes. And then I see the patients, and then when things are deteriorating, I see them in the emergency department. It becomes clear that they've never had a thoughtful, reflective conversation. So when I'm speaking to my students, not about life and death, but about the, working on their character traits, working on their moral strength. I'll sometimes say that like many different battles, it's not won in the moment on the playing field. It has to do with all the preparation that went into that. When you're facing down the Yetzer Hara, it's not a question of how much strength you have. It's a question of how much you've planned for that. You've anticipated that confrontation over time. Lahavdil, when you're facing down the Malach HaMagas, I think it's similar. That absolutely, as you said, the ability to deal with it calmly and confidently has a lot to do with the preparation that's happened until then. And then there's cases which you absolutely can't prepare for. There's sudden illness that no one saw coming. And that tests everybody, hospital staff included.
Okay, so we have a bunch of comments here.
I also want to add to Audrey's point, if I'm not mistaken, I don't know how it works exactly here in Israel. I would like to learn a little bit more as I continue working here. But these forms I just put into the chat are documents which one can fill out actually from the government, health, Ministry of Health, for power of attorney, and of course the living will, which is advanced directive. So if I'm not mistaken, somebody could actually, instead of just carrying it with them in their file, but can actually have their family doctor somehow upload it onto someone's chart. So when they're looking through information, I mean, maybe it seems too simple, but hopefully this is one of the ways to actually represent one's choices.
Okay, thanks. So that's in the chat.
And a couple of things I see on the chat here.
Yeah.
Two things I see in the chat that I want to respond to. One is a comment that it's never too soon to talk about this, and someone whose children keep putting them off. I think it's an important point. What I think is important to say is you don't have to have a worked out idea of what you'd want done, what you wouldn't want to have done, what a good death looks like. Sometimes, I've talked a few times about just empowering people. And sometimes it's enough to tell your loved ones, look, just do when the time comes, do what you think is right. And if it's to not treat me and to not intubate me, whatever it is, then I trust you. They don't have, sometimes it's all they need to feel the confidence to make choices in the moment. And sometimes it's just that simple to say to someone, you'll be my power of attorney if ever needed. And I trust you. Just, you're going to know what's the right thing to do. And don't be scared. And don't think you're betraying me. And don't think you're giving up. You just do, treat me if you want to treat, if you think I'm treatable. Don't let me go too easily, but just do what you think is right. The other point brought up about COVID, and it really, obviously COVID lingers over everything we do in every conversation we have. And in terms of how it's changed everything for families, it's horrible. What can I say? This is a horrible virus and a horrible pandemic. And it is particularly cruel, not in just the havoc it wreaks to people's bodies, but into the context in which illness happens. It isolates patients from their families. It isolates them, for that matter, from the caretakers. And that's been a really, really, really difficult challenge for the healthcare system, and obviously as well for the patients and the families involved. I work in the Corona Miyun, in the Corona Emergency Department in Shari Tzedek. So I see patients when they're initially suspected of having Corona and then first diagnosed. I'm not with them for their stay, let's say, in a Corona unit. And there are some things that we have gotten better at in terms of communication, in terms of finding ways to get families into very sick patients. But the underlying theme, probably from beginning to end, and never more so than the hospital's isolation. It's true for those of us who are healthy. It's true for those of us who are sick. And if Etta and I have talked endlessly about the power and meaning of accompaniment and family, and making decisions together, it's a struggle that we have not sufficiently overcome, but at least we haven't overcome. I certainly don't feel settled with it, and I don't think any other doctor in the clinical setting these days does either.
Anything on the COVID front that you want to add?
Well, I want to say that comment came from my mother. So thank you, and I miss you very much. All my parents here. I would say that in the most recent work, I didn't say this earlier, but I have opened up a private practice in spiritual care. And most of the people I've been working with have lost a loved one, a relative, afar. And even if there was an opportunity to go and visit and come back and then to have to be in quarantine, there is some of them have had that opportunity, some of them haven't. And there is a tremendous, tremendous gaping hole, even so much greater than would have been otherwise. Such a yearning, such sometimes regret and remorse and pain for really missing opportunities to be together. And I compare that to being at the bedside of somebody completely gloved and masked and, you know, without an opportunity, forget about even human touch, like to even read the facial expressions, which is so much of understanding somebody's, understanding the emotions behind what somebody's experiencing. So we are in a place of really of a huge amount of loss, and we're grieving. We're not just grieving, we're grieving the lives we would have otherwise been living. I join you all in that, in that pain and in that not knowing. And I would add, because one of the things we were talking about is, you know, one of the things I have learned, but, I would add that about and emphasize not being afraid to really express what you're really feeling, to put into words, because words can communicate so much. And sometimes we're so afraid of the words that we really want to say, like, I'm really going to miss you. Or, I'm so proud of you. We're afraid that sometimes those words are going to result in a person like giving up. Oh my gosh, I must be dying now. Am I dying? If you're telling me thank you and I love you and forgive you and blah, blah, blah. And so we end up controlling that. And I remember a conversation with this patient, a mother who said, I'm so proud of my kids because they're so brave and they're so strong, but she would look at me. And I asked her, you know, what do you mean by that? She said, well, they come and they see me, but they don't cry or anything. They're not crying. They must just be so brave and so strong. And underneath that, there was a fear. She was able to confide in me. There's this fear. Maybe they don't care enough about me if they're not crying. And of course the adult children would leave the room and of course sob, but they didn't want to bring that into the room. And so I just wanted to also, share that sometimes our tears, our expression, our articulation of emotion, of concern is actually really valid. And we can let the patient decide how much or how little they can take. But to censor ourselves for fear of what the patient, you know, can handle, it's not fully fair for the patient. So I just wanted to share that.
Well, very, very powerful example. Okay, I want to touch two more questions and we're going to call it the evening here. Number one, a question about Rabbi Goldberg. You spoke about that, about withholding and withdrawing care. Now, if someone's on a respiratory machine or a ventilator, are parents, you're not allowed to take them off on the ventilator once, you know, api halacha. So isn't that, what do poskim do in that situation? Is there an option of turning off the machine in such a situation?
Rebetha, I apologize, my internet unstable for a moment. I think you asked me about taking a patient off a ventilator.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult issue. Professor Avram Steinberg, who's one of this country and really the world's leading experts in Jewish medical ethics and particularly end of life care. He chaired a 59-member committee that wrote a law on terminal illness and its management in Israel. And it was a committee made up of Charedim, Datim Leumim, Chilonim, some Arab representatives, some Jews representatives. And I think they managed to find some consensus about everything except the issue of withdrawing about being extubated of a ventilator. And they agreed to disagree in the committee in terms of that policy. I mentioned,
like Rav Willig mentioned, that, you know, you can get off the train at some point, you know, in certain circumstances.
So it didn't. Here's where the devil is in the details and where, I have to mention the timer. Devil is in the details, and there is somewhat of a different perspective between the Rabbanim and the doctors. And the Rabbanim, you want to say, oh, you can get off the train, and the doctors say, sometimes, but it's not always so smooth. So some basic factual information. Most mainstream poskim, Rav Willig and Rav Schechter and others included, are not comfortable with the idea of extubating a patient. They see that as something that's hastening death as opposed to withholding care. So everything we've talked about, and myself, I stay within the guidelines established poskim, is about withholding care and then about withdrawing care. There are some minority views, if I'm not mistaken. You can go look this up before you, but I think Rav Chaim David Halevi, who was a major Sephardi posek, thought that extubating a patient might be acceptable, and there might be others as well. That's the name that comes to mind. Etha mentioned that in the wake of Professor Steinberg's experience on this committee, so they proposed the idea of putting ventilators on timers. In other words, it's an automatically expiring treatment, and let's say every X number of hours or days, you have to actively choose if you want to extend it or not. So it happens to be, this goes back a few summers ago, and we were on a family getaway in Kibbutz Lavi, and we found ourselves in the same room eating on Shabbos as the Steinberg family. So I spoke to Professor Steinberg literally over the chopped liver, taking it off the buffet at the Kibbutz Lavi. First, I poured out my heart to him of something that I thought I had done wrong in the hospital, where I thought I had hastened the patient's death, and he consoled me. And then I said to him, "Whatever happened to your timer idea?" So he said, "It takes a lot of work to put it into practice, and needs to go through trials, and needs to go through out." He said, but in fact, over time, the very idea has become somewhat obsolete because of other recommendations. And these are recommendations that he put forward, a little different than my own, but ones that he put forward in the name of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and the name of Rav Walzner, also about withholding or at least or not continuing care if a patient seems to be terminal. He has rulings that he got rabbinic endorsement about, that a patient who is simply irrecoverable, that you can't withdraw care completely, but you can reduce extra treatment to its kind of physiological minimum. So such as you can slowly turn down the level of oxygen the patient is getting. Or if the patient's getting medication to sustain their blood pressure, you don't have to replace the next bag. And he said, this goes back a few years, so it's somewhat dated, that that protocol, at least in Shari Tzedek, where they were working, using it, had found to be effective enough for many of the difficult situations that the whole timer, the ventilator on a timer idea was not necessarily as crucial. It still may be relevant, it still may be in development, but it is certainly true that the devil is in the details, and I would never on overpromise someone that you can jump off the train any way, anyhow. That too is also a very nuanced issue.
Okay, so there's a final question here. You know, how do you respond to the suffering patient that chooses euthanasia, the ultimate expression of autonomy? We've been speaking a lot about autonomy. Is there a limit to autonomy?
It's an interesting question. Just earlier this last week, I was reviewing a draft of a paper someone had sent me, discussing euthanasia in halacha, and where the paper essentially argued that it's not as much of a taboo as the as I guess conventional wisdom would say. That there are a number of poskim who think that a patient who is suffering terribly or would want to end their life or have someone else end their life in order to avoid terrible suffering may have some halachic basis. I wouldn't call it, I'm not in a position to judge it or to judge the poskim. The Chazal probably say, comment about the beginning of Megillah Rut, it says, "Bimei Shvot HaShoftim," in the days when the people were judging the judges. So I'm not in the position to say what poskim, you know, what's a good psak or a bad psak, or even a mainstream or not mainstream. I guess, I'll quote my wife here. My wife is a teacher of halacha. And she says that she has many goals in teaching halacha. One of them is to teach people how to live up to the expectations of Judaism. Another one of the things she goals is that to teach people to look kindly upon their neighbors, that things that they thought were outlandish behavior, they may learn has some basis within a halachic opinion. It might not be the mainstream or the popular opinion, but it's out there. I guess I would say the same thing about euthanasia. I don't think it's the mainstream opinion, even if it technically are possible. I think there's a lot of practical, ethical concerns about euthanasia as policy. But were there someone who practiced it or at least ascribed to it or at least fantasized about it, there may be some basis within the full breadth of the halachic possibility that we don't have to write that off as an anti-Torah idea, I guess I would say.
Well, very very interesting. I did not expect that that answer, but so we're gonna bring things to a close here. I want to thank both of our presenters, Rabbi Judah Goldberg, Rabbi Anit Etta. I want to thank you both for bringing a very human face to death, and a challenging conversation, but it's so important. And it's really powerful to hear your stories and your insights dealing with people in times of crisis from a medical, pastoral, emotional, spiritual standpoint. And please God, that we shouldn't know of these crises that you speak about, but we should live life to the fullest and recognize that every day we have to value our relationships and value every moment and make the most of it. So thank you all for your participation.
I just wanted to, one thing that I did not mention and that I do think is really important, especially, you know, in this moment, is the how important it is to support one another and staff in the hospital being able to have a place and a space to actually, to really, to vent, to explore, to receive also care. There are, from, you know, the doctors that I know who are working endless hours, nurses and social workers and, you know, other types of healthcare practitioners in the hospital setting. And that is one thing that I really do feel needs more, needs much more support here in Israel. You know, back in the States, we had what was called Schwartz rounds, where people in almost every hospital, like 90% of hospitals, not only were there chaplains, but there were people would come together to for chaplains to facilitate like these groups where people could actually talk about what it really means to be with a patient who's just been extubated. You've just extubated a patient. I mean, these are so very, very hard decisions. And I also want to you know, thank you, Rav Goldberg, for being here. And I really do hope that also the doctors and the other healthcare practitioners out there doing such important work also have the ability to really find some extra support in these, in this really, especially this pandemic in this time.
And I'll add to that. So let's all try to do what we can. You know, you have a cousin or a friend or a neighbor who's a nurse, doctor, paramedic, you know, give them a call just to show some support and at this critical time. So wishing you all Erev Tov. Thank you so much. And
as well.
Say again, Rabbi.
And the chaplains as well.
And the chaplains as well. Amen. So Erev Tov Lekulam.
Thank you.
And join us. We'll, you know, we're going to continue these series over the next few weeks, please God. So we'll see you back on Sunday night. Kol Tov and Erev Tov Lekulam.
Erev Tov. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.